Okay, we're moving right now to the next panel, and that will be chaired by Guillaume Etier. Guillaume Etier est urbanologue. Il est actuellement stagiaire postdoctoral à l'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill et ainsi que chercheur associé à la chaire de recherche du Canada en patrimoine urbain. Récemment, il a été stagiaire postdoctoral à l'école d'architecture de l'Université d'Edinburgh. Après des études en sociologie, il a complété une thèse de doctorat en études urbaines à l'Université de Montréal qui lui a valu notamment les prix Phyllis Lambert 2014 de la Société pour l'étude de l'architecture au Canada et le prix Jean-Pierre Collin 2014 du réseau Ville Région Monde.
Thank you very much, Will, for that presentation. I am obviously very pleased to be here today to moderate the Cities, Territories, World panel. So I will explain to you in a second what that means. Donc, je suis tout à fait ravi d'être ici aujourd'hui pour modérer ce panel. Alors, et je suis donc en particulier content, je suis en particulier ravi d'être ici, considérant, donc on le voit pas en ce moment, mais quand j'ai vu hier le logo de la conférence, je voyais donc un logo où on voit le Canada et où on voit l'ensemble des icônes architecturales du Canada, ce qui me rappelle par hasard que mon livre, j'ai un livre qui va sortir cette année, qui s'appelle « L'architecture iconique, les leçons de Toronto ». Alors ça sortira au mois de mai, donc voilà, ça me fait clin d'œil, donc je vante un peu... ma présentation pour l'instant.
So the idea behind this panel was to move beyond inner cities or cities strictly defined to see cities in their broader ecological and geographical context. We're really trying to look outwards in that panel. So maybe the mayor of Stratford, Dan, not Don, it's Dan, right? Dan, yeah, Dan. Dan Matthewson put it best yesterday when he said, maybe the question of this conference is, how we not leave anyone behind in cities? So that could be one of the questions we're gonna ask in that presentation today. So I'm going to introduce the panelists and then ask each one of them to give a short individual presentation before we open up the group discussion, and then eventually we're gonna open the floor for some questions afterwards. There's one panelist missing, so Mr. Fabrice Labeau, who's a teacher, engineer and teacher at McGill, couldn't make it today. He's sick, apparently.
So we're only gonna be three? No, I'm sure he's right.
It's pretty cold outside, and I'm sick too. Everybody's sick, so we're all on the same page here. So there's going to be three of us, and you'll see that it's a very diverse panel, and I think that is fairly common when we talk about cities. The focus, and you know, cities are such a complex phenomenon that it's. Usually what happens is that people from different backgrounds gather and try to understand each other on certain issues.
Donc, je vais vous présenter maintenant les trois membres de ce panel. Et ensuite, je vais demander à chacun d'eux de venir donc faire une courte présentation individuelle
avant d'ouvrir la discussion de groupe. Alors, Gorka Espio is the Director of Innovation for Cities and Regions at the Young Foundation. SPO is also a founding partner of the Social Innovation Laboratory Co-op, a member of the International Advisory Group of INCOR, of the University of Ulster, and Social Innovation Exchange Country Ambassador. Previously, he was the head of international programs at InnovaLab, and served as senior advisor to the executive office of the Basque president. He is also a former senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and a former senior associate to CRCR at Columbia University.
Nous aurons ensuite la chance d'écouter Madame Louise Gay, qui est présidente du Centre de co-création et d'innovation ouverte Living Lab de Montréal.
où elle mène des projets porteurs en transport urbain intelligent, en ludification et en économie ouverte, qui permettent d'expérimenter de nouvelles approches de consultation publique et de mobilisation des ressources et des idées de toute provenance. Alors que la citoyenneté se mue en une nouvelle civilité de l'innovation sociale Web 2.0 et que la géolocalisation se démocratise, les usagers devenus mobiles interagissent de plus en plus avec de petites et moyennes entreprises qui peuvent dès lors offrir des programmes de fidélisation personnalisés à un plus grand nombre de clients. Utilisant le Living Lab comme plateforme, les citoyens de Montréal vont de nouveau faire entendre leur voix dans les processus d'innovation et participer dans la mouvance et le changement de leur ville. Madame Guay possède une grande maîtrise du positionnement stratégique, de la planification agile et de la création de richesses par la technologie, autant auprès de start-ups que d'entreprises bien établies. Son parcours professionnel est impressionnant et comporte plusieurs véritables innovations. La première salle d'essayage en ligne avec mannequin 3D configurable, l'identité virtuelle, la personnalisation de l'expérience usagée, le shopping social, un pictionnaire de mode et la recherche visuelle de style. And then last but not least, we're going to have John Broadhead. So you've seen him this morning in a video. He's the first executive director of CityWorks, a new strategic initiative of Evergreen. A national charity whose aim is to build green cities. CityWorks engages citizens and builds multi-sector collaborations to help decision makers make cities more livable and resilient. Its focus is on urban infrastructure, in particular sustainable transportation and housing. Prior to joining CityWorks, John was Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and Cabinet Affairs for Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty, and served in other roles in the Office of the Premier, including Executive Director of Communications and Senior Policy Advisor. John was also Vice President for Strategic and Communications for Metrolink, the regional transit agency for the Greater Toronto Area. John is currently an Executive Fellow at the Mowat Centre for Public Policy at the University of Toronto. He lives in Toronto with his wife, Alexandra, and their three kids under the age of 4. Right, is that factual? Three, eh? Right. All right, so I'm going to now ask each of the presentation and each of the panelists to do a presentation, and then we'll move on with the panel. Thank you.
Hello, thank you very much for the invitation. Okay, so just two words about the Young Foundation. For those who are not familiar, it takes the name from Michael Young, who was one of the first social innovators. Many years ago, he actually was able to be part of the very small group of thinkers that actually redesigned the welfare state after the Second World War in the UK. And then he decided that he was going to start doing what we call today social innovation, that at that time didn't exist. And among many other things, he created the Open University, the first school of social entrepreneurs, and words like social innovation and social entrepreneurs that are with us today. So the Young Foundation, just a couple of years ago, realized that we had a lot of programs in this very non very tangible world of social innovation in a lot of areas, but that we have never concentrated all those programs in one particular place. So the analysis was that the projects on social transformation and social innovation were getting better and better, but the impact of those projects was still very, very limited because the challenges that we try to tackle are very complex. And so we needed a more complex system approach and a whole city approach. So we
we created this this program.
Let me see if I can. Yeah. And they invited me to run this program because I come from the city of Bilbao, and Bilbao has also been sometimes associated with a successful transformation. And I will tell you a bit more about that. But basically, what we are trying to achieve with through the Cities Program at the Young Foundation is to rethink or to think more critically about what a smart city means. And because the evidence that we have today is that technology actually deploying cities in the way that smart cities programs are operating actually is increasing the inequality gap. So the more technology that we deploy in certain ways, the bigger the inequality gap gets. And the logic is quite simple because only certain type of educated people, like the ones that are here today, have access to certain types of technology. So if we don't rethink the way that we are deploying all this technology, actually we might end up having a very, very negative result. And it's not me saying this. This is MIT. You can read that and Technology Review, Technology and Inequality. And you can also read many other authors. So this is, I think, is a very important starting point. And I'm sorry that we don't have the professor from the university, because I think he would have had a more technical and pure smart city approach. And we could have had a good conversation about that. But this is, I think, this analysis that is becoming mainstream. A couple of years ago, it was only very radical voices. And now it is quite an evidence. So the other dimension that we were requested to discuss today is about the city and region dimension, what I think is very, very important, because we are also oversimplifying what the city means and the relationship between the city and the region. We normally say, well, cities where, you know, the interesting things are happening, and the region is the conservative people that try to get the city, you know, not moving. And I think it's a bit more complicated than that. So, for example, if you look at the Bilbao case, the really simplistic approach is that Bilbao was a very terrible city with unemployment, violence, industrial collapse. And then Frank Gehry came, and he did this building, and now it's a wonderful place. And I mean, it sounds funny, but this is really the story that that you get when you talk about the Bilbao effect. So many, many cities in the world have tried to replicate this. So, okay, so we do a building like this, and then the city will transform. Fantastic. And I can tell you a lot of my friends in Bilbao are doing really well today, just selling that story around the world. But the impact of that approach, as you can imagine, is very, very poor. So what happened really, and you can have a, that's all also very, very well documented, is that the Guggenheim Bilbao has worked because it is an expression of a transformation, as a socio-economic transformation that already took place before Frank Gehry arrived. So the, and it's very, I think it's very easy to understand as well, that at that moment where and I have had this discussion with a former president of the Basque Country who actually signed a check for the Guggenheim Foundation and Frank Gehry and the others, is that the reason for them to sign that check was because they needed something to represent the transformation, not the other way around. And if you go back into that transformation, what happened was that actually it was a transformation based on social economy and social innovation. So there is, it is not a coincidence that our GDP in the Basque Country, 20% of our GDP is based on social economy. We are, we have the largest industrial cooperative in the world, Mondragon, that employs about 75,000 people in industrial manufacturing. So actually, it was that reconstruction of the society based on social economy that generated the money that could have been, that was invested in the building. Okay? And that reconstruction, it didn't happen in the city. Actually happened in the region, if we understand the Basque Country as a 3 million people country region. That's for the political discussion. Okay, so so I think you will be very familiar to those type of dynamics. Okay, so at the Young Foundation, what we are really interested now is on understanding this growing inequality gap. So, because this is an effect of a system crisis that is affecting all Western societies, and for the first time, most of us will probably see that our children are going to have a poorer quality of life of what we have had. And this, in terms of human history, this is a big change. Because if you look back, you know, for centuries, you know, the increase has been quite steady in terms of life expectancy, health, income, etc., etc. And now we have reached a point where actually it's going down. And you can see life expectancy, for example, in certain cities, in certain neighborhoods in certain cities in North America actually is decreasing. So you have, depending on where you live and depending on your incomes, your life expectancy is lower than those who live in the neighborhood that is just across the road. So this is inequality for us. And inequality is not inequality of resources only. It's also inequality of representation and inequality of recognition, something that we have just discussed in the previous panel. And you cannot understand inequality if you don't look from this triple angle, because normally we try to reduce into the inequality of resources. So that's our concern, and that's what we are doing. And as you can imagine, that there are many, many people out there trying to tackle this problem as well. So what I'm telling you about is how are we in practice, how are we trying to generate a different approach of how we transform cities. This program is based on the experience of the Basque Country, but also in many other similar cities and regions that have been able actually to transform themselves positively from very difficult conditions. So we can talk about Medellin, we can talk about Belfast, we can talk about cities that have faced particular deep problems. And what we have found in through this analysis is that, and I think also this is very relevant to you, is very well connected with what was discussed before, is that projects and project delivery, it is part of the equation. So you need to do things. But unless it is connected to a change in the narrative of the place, and by narrative, we understand how people perceive themselves and how people perceive themselves in the context of the city. Unless we change that narrative, projects actually don't have an impact. So you need two things. You need to change in practical things, services, in the way the city operates. But you also need a cultural change, that is a deeper change in the way that people perceive themselves and the way that the city perceives people and the interaction between the two. And so what we do is we apply ethnographic research that, for those who are not familiar, is a qualitative methodology in trying to observe in real environments how people live, and try to go deeper than the traditional analysis of dialogue and questionnaire. Because a lot of the analysis that we are doing about cities and about how people operate in the city, it's quite superficial, because you are trying to normally to get ideas about very complex issues with very different profiles of individuals. So there are people who are able to express themselves in the way that you can codify, or the way that the university will understand that. But there are many, many other elements that are not possible to be understood in that particular framework. So we have the legacy of Michael Young and his team that started doing ethnography in East London 50 years ago. And so to understand how communities coming from all around the world were organizing themselves in London in order to co-design services with the, with those communities. So this is that something that sounds very modern, and we talk about actually is about 50 years old. And we have been, we have seen a lot of good and bad examples of how to apply this. So what we are doing is in this, I'm going to give you an example of Belfast, because I think Belfast is quite difficult a scenario. So if you can do this in Belfast, you can tell me that you can do it in Montreal or many other places. So in Belfast, Northern Ireland, we are conducting an ethnographic research that starts with this, with trying to capture the current narratives on the place and how people perceive inequality in their daily life. And from that particular angle, then when we have a picture of how people perceive themselves now, we also ask them what kind of values they would like to associate with in the future. So then we have the picture of what is today and what are the values they would like to associate in the future, and then we can make the transition through projects. Okay, so if you look at this description of the methodology, we start by conducting this research. And the key thing is that this research is not about dialogue per se. It's about listening and then getting involved in dialogue. So for many years, I've been involved in the peace movement in the Basque Country, and this has been one of the most fundamental lessons that I learned there, is that actually there is no dialogue without a very, very deep listening process. And dialogue actually is not a good way to listen, because you normally try to convince the other person about your ideas. And so you need to kind of go back and try to listen in a much deeper way. And then from there, once you have listened, you try to explain your narrative. The other person will explain their narrative. And in the dialogue between narratives, new narrative emerges. But there is no a process of a curve, how you convince really another person. So this is the process, but I'll give you in very, very detailed and short way. So okay, we conduct this through local people. We work in all areas of the city. And very importantly, we don't conduct research only in deprived areas, because that's normally what government and university does. You need to understand how people who live in deprived areas, but you need to understand as well how those people who take the decisions are also living and thinking. Because those are, so you need to involve in the same ethnographic research the people that are suffering the problem, those who are taking the decisions, those who have the money, and those who are reinforcing, you know, that are actually making things to happen. So we actually combine a very, very diverse group, and we try to get all those stories and ideas into very simple kind of groups of themes. That can be about mental health, death, gender, you know, it's kind of various. But then you go into the detail of what are the values, what are that people associate themselves with, that actually in a deeper level than just what is the problem. Okay, so I'll give you some examples of the ideas that we have codified from this research. For example, one person saying, the city center is diverse and beautiful, but it's absurd extending that beauty into the rest of the city. So this is what a lot of people think in the city. If you ask to people who are well-educated, they will never say this. If you actually go deeper into the analysis, you will find that people think that their neighborhoods actually deserve that. In a place like Belfast, for example. Another idea that probably you will not find in a normal research or dialogue is this idea about ghosts, the ghosts that normally are in the city, and the ghosts that I enjoyed very much the presentation from Bogota yesterday, because I think he was explaining very, very well what these ghosts mean. But the most interesting thing is that the common purpose need, the need for common purpose. How do you fight ghosts only if you get people together. Then also you will find this not only in Belfast but in many other cities, that there is kind of a collective narrative as well about that in the past it was easier to have a purpose. So the economy and social economy in the past, that it was a social economy of how you can provide food and basic needs to your family, was actually much better structured. In the moment where today we have more developed and complex societies, then it is more difficult. So this idea is also very common. And then you get into a deeper level of in the dialogue, not in the first phase, but the second, probably the third phase, where people will start saying, we cannot rely on the council to do this. But this normally doesn't happen at the beginning of the process. It actually comes later in the dialogue. And the last phase of sophistication in the dialogue is when people actually say, we are the real experts. We are the real experts. And that's the key, because when people understand that's real empowerment. But that is a process. You don't get people in the room, you know, in the first moment saying, we are the real experts. It's, you know, process dialogue. So then we transform this into values that are associated with the negative elements, inequality. But we also discover values that are positive, normally associated with the private and personal sphere. So people normally have a two type of narratives. One is the narrative about the outside world and about the politics, and that's normally negative. So the place like Belfast is never going to change. This is negative. When you ask it about their inner values, they are normally positive about the family, about the way that they conduct their lives. So there is this kind of double set of values that you need to operate with. And then from there on, you can actually create a new narrative in the discussion, a new narrative of transformation. So actually, what is the story that we can tell about how this place can change? And our experience is that unless we get to this point where you actually can tell the story and people associate themselves with the narrative of transformation, then change is not possible. In the Basque Country, for example, when we conduct this analysis, it's very clear that all levels of society at some point decided that they were part of this movement of transformation. And this is a collective decision. It is not a fact. It's a collective decision at some point that people take about what kind of narrative they would like to associate with. So this is the... And then when you do all that process, then you can build a Guggenheim. Okay? So then the Guggenheim works, and works very well still, because it is pretty deep connected with the story of transformation. You will not find one person, especially if you ask, for example, old people in the city, you will not, and this is a very modern building, you can say, you will not find one person that doesn't like this building in Bilbao. Because this building represents their transformation. And there's where, when magic happens, when you connect the two. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Espau. Je vais maintenant demander à Madame Louise Gay de nous faire sa présentation.
Bonjour, alors je me présente, je suis Louise Gay. Je peux faire ma présentation en français et en anglais, les deux. Alors, je veux remercier William Stra pour cette invitation et Emmanuel Caron aussi, un entrepreneur qui m'a fait connaître cette conférence et c'est comme ça que je vous ai contacté. Je voudrais simplement prendre quelques minutes pour penser au titre « Ville, territoire, monde ». J'aime bien cette dynamique qui n'est pas ville, province, pays ou nation. C'est vraiment ville, territoire, monde. Et c'est dans cette optique que j'ai envie qu'on fasse un petit bout de chemin ensemble. Et simplement quelques mots pour vous expliquer ce qu'est le Living Lab de Montréal. Moi, je suis une entrepreneur en série. J'ai créé plusieurs entreprises dans le monde des œuvres d'art, des collections d'art. Mais c'était ma thèse de doctorat pour les enfants, permettent aux enfants de créer leur propre collection et leur propre identité au travers des œuvres d'art. J'ai fait ça quand Bill Gates négociait des droits pour Corbis. Moi, je bâtissais un petit musée de poche. Ça m'a amené ensuite dans le monde des collections des vêtements. Et il me semblait que la technologie avait vraiment une promesse de pouvoir démocratiser les accès. Donc, j'ai travaillé au niveau de plateformes collaboratives pour que des entreprises comme Adidas puissent vendre avant de produire en mettant une plateforme collaborative au service des designers des collections. C'était un véritable changement d'approche et j'ai vu combien la collaboration était difficile à réaliser parce que quand on est designer, on veut posséder son propre design, mais quand on y arrivait, c'était incroyable l'impact. Ça m'a amené à rencontrer des gens au MIT dans le monde des villes. J'ai rencontré toute une équipe autour de Bill Mitchell qui commençait de travailler au niveau des living labs, des laboratoires ou urbains, où ce que l'on fait au niveau des prototypes ou des pilotes se fait toujours à échelle réelle. On ne prend pas le monde pour le mettre dans un laboratoire, on prend le laboratoire et on l'amène dans le monde. Alors, il y a presque 5 ans maintenant, on a créé le Living Lab à la suite, donc, en fait, en collaboration avec nos partenaires du Media Lab, qui ont vu que Montréal, c'était une ville qui avait une très belle taille, qui se sont dit, tiens, ça pourrait être un beau laboratoire vivant, même comme ville. Et Louise, avec ton équipe, vous pourriez apporter toute votre expérience de la smart customization, puisque les villes sont en train de se transformer et de devenir, en fait, le nouveau web. Alors, on s'est mis à travailler, il y a des gens dans la salle que je connais, avec qui on a fait un petit bout de chemin. On a d'abord étudié les déplacements. On s'est dit, pour comprendre où s'en vont les gens, on va étudier à partir des données des cellulaires comment les gens se déplacent. Et on a vite compris que les gens étaient devenus mobiles, que les gens ne vivaient plus comme au 20e siècle, qu'ils étaient devenus flexibles, mais que la ville ne répondait pas aux services dont ils avaient besoin. Alors ici, j'imagine que c'est de là qu'on... sur le... Donc, travailler au centre-ville. Montréal veut être une ville intelligente. Elle a un énorme problème de congestion. C'est pour ça qu'on avait commencé en étudiant les déplacements. On s'était dit, ça n'a pas de sens que les gens soient dans leur voiture soir et matin, dans l'ancien symbole de la liberté, enfermés dans leur voiture pour pouvoir venir travailler. C'est insensé. Alors, on s'est dit peut-être qu'on devrait développer des applications mobiles pour leur permettre de leur proposer, en utilisant les fonctionnalités des cellulaires, des trajets alternatifs, avec des systèmes de récompenses plus élaborés encore que les systèmes de fidélisation où toute la ville se mettrait à jouer de manière sérieuse pour changer son comportement, pour faire plus de carpooling, déplacer des vélos. Mais en regardant bien comme il faut les chiffres, on s'est rendu compte que oui, ça va être formidable quand les transports publics vont être encore plus présents, mais ça ne suffira pas. Qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire pour qu'on passe du 20e siècle au 21e siècle? Alors, on s'est dit, il faut penser la ville non pas comme un centre attractif, angoissé, qui oblige les gens toujours à venir vers elle le matin, à repartir le soir, mais si on comprenait mieux ce qui se passe au niveau de la ville, du territoire et de son monde. Les fameuses banlieues, plus de 50% habitent en banlieue, et quand on regarde comment dans certaines parties du monde, en Europe entre autres, on a banni du lieu, c'est ça la banlieue des gens, Et maintenant, on se retrouve avec des énormes problèmes urbanistiques. On se dit, mais qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire ici pour faire autrement? Alors, on s'est dit, mais qu'est-ce qui fait que les gens se déplacent? Quelle est la première raison pour laquelle croyez-vous que les gens se déplacent? Il y a quelqu'un qui veut s'essayer? Exactement. On déplace les gens pour venir travailler. Pourquoi on ne déplacerait pas le travail pour le rapprocher des gens? Parce que le travail, c'est une tâche que l'on accomplit. Ce n'est pas un lieu. Travailler à la maison. Qui travaille à la maison ici? Ah, il y en a du monde, hein? Télétravail. Est-ce que vous aimez ça, travailler à la maison? Do you like it to work at home? Why? Absolutely. Did you hear what he said? You need to interact with people. So imagine if you could work in a kind of third place. Qui a pensé au third place? Monsieur Starbuck. He is rich because he understood that with technology, you can work anywhere, anytime. But it is a cafe. It is not a working place. So now many cafes are stuck with the problem, and they put some sign in their windows, and they say, you're not allowed to use your computer all the time because it's a cafe. It's not a smart working center. So, but at least we know that we can work anytime, anywhere. And we need to go out. We need smart working center. We are ready for it. We are mobile. Because, hey, I was in the old Montreal. Have you noticed how many places are to be rent? Bureau à louer. Everywhere. In every cities, you have, I think it's from 30% of the space, it is empty. University during the summer, it's empty. So how could we work differently? And the owner, the employers, they want to cut their real estate expenses. So what do, mister? They give you the burden. You have to work at your place, disbalancing your family life and your work, and you are not paid to do this. So employers more and more have to think, wow, how can I cut my expenses, but at the same time, give great, smart working centers to my employee if I want to recruit the best talent, especially in the XYZ gen. So, employees, they want to have a better balance with their family. Some people travel 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening. Some people sleep at their office in Asia, absolutely, because it's crazy the time that they take in their car. So we have to change this. How do we do this? So we know that the way we move have transformed who we are. I mention him, and this one says, you work all the time, so now take vacants, holidays, anytime. The network is mobile as well. So I love, again, les villes, territoires et monde, because imagine we use technology and we bring this idea of city in the region, in the suburb, as in the midtown. How do we do this? Here in Quebec, we have an incredible network called Les Caisses Desjardins. And it's a bank, a special bank, c'est une coopérative, and now they have all this free space, parce que les gens ne vont plus à la banque. So they sell their branches. As they are located strategically on the Quebec territory, imagine we would transform it into smart working centers. It would allow us to bring high-speed internet, and you know that people need this to work. They use technology to consume, but when you use it to work, you create wealth. So it would be a great opportunity for people to, on créerait, je dirais, alléluia, des services de proximité, because you were talking about a kind of retrofit of resilient urban cells. Et dans les régions, tout le monde a vu le film La Grande Séduction. C'est une tragédie déguisée en comédie. Alors, je peux vous dire que quand la caisse ferme en région, après que l'église soit fermée, que le bureau de poste soit fermé, quand on ferme la banque, c'est terrible. Et vous savez, pensons-y, qu'est-ce que c'est fonder une nouvelle cité? Eh bien, c'est de la terre, des bâtiments, des ressources financières, une banque, c'est pas n'importe laquelle, c'est une coopérative, et la communication. À notre époque, c'est l'Internet haute vitesse. On a tout ça, et moi je dis à M. Coderre et à son équipe, et à Mme Leroux, the CEO of Desjardins, we should be the first city in the world d'être la ville réseau. Et ne pas être anxieux pour faire venir les gens, mais leur dire, vous savez quoi, on va encourager l'économie des réseaux en région, en banlieue, et vous allez voir que ça va créer plus de richesses et que ça va dynamiser la ville. C'est non pas la ville intelligente, mais les villes intelligentes de partage. Donc, 1400 points de service, déjà un nouveau lieu pour mon travail, ajusté à mes besoins, où je peux me concentrer, collaborer, communiquer. On peut imaginer qu'il y ait des services de première ligne du point de vue de la banque. C'est certain que les gens de Desjardins pourraient offrir leurs services aux employés des entreprises, mais aussi aux travailleurs autonomes, aux entrepreneurs, aux représentants, bref, à plein de gens qui bientôt, d'ailleurs, plein de gens vont se retrouver à devoir aller à plein d'endroits parce que le marché nous montre que les travailleurs autonomes sont en croissance. Et c'est mieux qu'à la maison et c'est plus fun qu'au bureau. Mon espace réservé et où je suis connectée. Donc, c'est notre projet au cœur du village urbain et je crois que c'est une façon d'approcher l'intelligence émotionnelle des villes. Voilà.
And now I'd like to welcome John Broadhead to do his little presentation. So I was going to show a video, but apparently that was already done earlier. So, just kidding. I knew that was going to happen. First of all, I wanted to thank the organizers. As you heard, I have three kids under the age of four. So last night was an amazing night's sleep. If I look a little bedridden, it's because I actually just woke up from that brilliant night's sleep. So thank you to Will and the organizing team for inviting me. When I think about the region, our background, as was mentioned, is, Evergreen's been around for 25 years. It's a national organization working to make cities more green, more sustainable. And CityWorks was started a couple of years ago to, A, tackle the issue of infrastructure, so transit and housing, and the impact those have on our cities, and also to take a more focused lens on policymaking and what we can do to help policymakers make better decisions when it comes to urban infrastructure. So CityWorks, we basically do three things. One is we convene large multi-sector collaborations around key issues to present policymakers with very clear and distinct policy agendas. Secondly, we do a whole lot of citizen engagement. And thirdly, we prototype. When ideas are stuck in the system, we can prototype them and de-risk some of this for policymakers. So having spent 10 years in the federal and provincial governments, I think one of the things I always heard when I worked in the Premier's office was, why don't you guys just take leadership on this issue? Just take leadership. Just do it. I know the public's not with you. I know they're not even talking about this, but just go take a punch in the head for us. And, that works. I lived through the HST in Ontario and the health premium tax increase. But it really, if you're expecting leaders to do that on their own, we're probably going to be quite disappointed, and change is going to take a lot longer than it needs to on some of these issues.
So one leader that I worked for in the past, I came to him with a crazy idea. It was actually sheer lunacy. And he said, listen, I actually like that idea. Now go and build me a parade I can jump in front of. And I think that's a really important point that guides a lot of our work is how can we build parades to allow leaders the freedom to make really difficult decisions? And I want to talk about this in a regional context because one of the fascinating things we've learned as we've done our citizen engagement work is we have to think like a region in terms of citizen engagement. And that's making our job much more difficult, and it's changing the tools we need to do this. And I'll give you one big example. We run a collaboration in the GTA called Move the GTA. So it's Greater Toronto Area. It's about public transit financing. So there's a great public transit plan. It's about $90 billion. And we have about $16 billion of it currently on the table. So there's a little bit of a gap. So we were trying to find a way to help the provincial government in Ontario make a very tough political decision in terms of raising new revenue for public transit. And we have 50 organizations. We have labor sitting next to the Board of Trade. We have the environmentalists sitting next to the registered nurses. We had a really strong collaboration. And we looked around the room about a year ago, maybe a year and a few months ago, and I said, so who's talking to the public right now? And especially, who's talking to the 905, which is the ring around Toronto, for those of you who aren't as familiar, which is where all the small P political power is held on these types of regional decisions, where issues like traffic congestion and transit are actually A, would be the biggest cost borne by them, and B, the biggest benefits if it was changed. So we had a bunch of citizen engagement tools already on the ground. We had partnered with a group doing door knocking in Toronto. We were doing op-eds. We were doing ads in the paper, radio shows. And we decided we needed to take a slightly different angle of attack. So we brought in two tools that were a little different in nature, but were able to allow us to reach people in new ways in the region. So one of them was a very interesting partnership with Air Miles. So Canadians, as I've learned, are the most loyal people in the world. We attach ourselves to these loyalty programs like nobody else. So, and Air Miles is our biggest loyalty program. To the point where in the GTA, 89% of families actively collect Air Miles. 89% of families. So Air Miles has this great little arm called Air Miles for Social Change that partner with great organizations like Evergreen CityWorks to get access to their list of clients, of which there are 774,000 in the region. So in one day, we blasted out a note about public transit and the benefits of public transit and the need to move and said to people, listen, we'll give you 20 Air Miles to come to our website and fill out this survey and engage on this issue. 12 hours and 50,000 people later, we had to shut down the website. We burned through 500,000 Air Miles. And for those of you who know Air Miles, 20 Air Miles doesn't get you very far. 20 Air Miles barely got me from the lunch table to here. And people will really do anything for 20 Air Miles, and including do the largest unintended survey about public transit by accident in the GTA's history. So it was a really interesting tool, and when we looked at the data, it showed that we were really hitting into the 905. We followed that up with a tool called Telephone Town Halls, which you don't want to get confused with robocalls. They're different. Similar technology, but different, where we actually dialed at the same time, the partner of ours dials 300,000 numbers at the same time, and we invite people to join a telephone town hall with the premier, in this case, about the future of public transit. And it's very inexpensive. We are actually targeting it to the 905, so we didn't do any of those calls into the city. We were able to target just the demographics we wanted to talk to. And the amazing thing is we were expecting kind of 5% of people to stay on the line. We were hitting about almost 20% of people were staying on the line, and they were staying on the line an average of 17 minutes. So we were having a real conversation. And the premier was taking questions, and the head of the transit agency was taking questions. It was all questions. We were getting real-time polling while we were doing this. And I use this as an example to illustrate we're going to need to think differently about citizen engagement when we're going across a region of 6 million people. and in other regions across the country. And I look at how Vancouver is, very late launching their yes campaign for their transit referendum, and I really hope that we're advising them on that. But they need to use some serious tools because, you know, they're going to have a similar challenge. It's not the inner cores that are the actual decision makers in terms of public opinion on this stuff, and it's not who decision makers in Ontario are looking at in terms of where are their heads at. Nobody's saying, where are the downtown Toronto people on carbon pricing? That's not what they're worried about, but they're very worried about Brampton, Mississauga, London, Ontario, and some of the outskirts of these city regions. So maybe I'll leave it at that and just say one of the interesting things is you put up here the cities we need as one of the titles, and the more I kind of think about it, it's actually the citizenry we need, and finding ways to help citizens engage in these issues in meaningful ways that can help us clear that space for decision makers to make some of the truly challenging decisions they face right now. So happy to take questions after, and thank you so much.
All right, so as you can see, relationship between the city centers and surroundings is obviously a very broad question. So the way we worked here is that we proposed a question to focus the discussion a little bit. So I'm going to read to you the question, and then I'll ask each of you to answer it. So cities today seem to be developing in two directions. On the one end, regional transportation networks, telecommuting, smart grids, and the displacement of public space from physical to virtual environment seem to be pulling apart the city as we know it, blurring the differences between a city and its surroundings. On the other hand, cities are trying to position themselves as distinctive urban environments in an age in which every city wants to have an identity in a global context. This usually leads to an emphasis on the traditional central part of the cities. So how do you see this tension developing in the future? So un mot en français, donc on a à la fois des forces centrifuges comme le télétravail notamment, qui nous porte à croire que l'urbain est de plus en plus diffus et de plus en plus partout. On n'a plus besoin en soi des villes. Et dans un autre sens, il y a des forces centripètes qui font en sorte que, on en parle depuis deux jours, les villes semblent, donc les centres semblent plus importants que jamais. Alors, donc, c'est la question générale que vous avez posée. How do you see this developing?
Okay. As I tried to explain before, I think identity, it's really a powerful tool that in the current discussions about the smart city seems to have disappeared. And I think it was this morning as well, former mayor of Vancouver, who actually was talking about identity. And I think identity can be a positive or a negative instrument. It depends how do you frame it. But the possibility of creating movements of transformation at the city level that is about the citizens, that is about what kind of values people identify themselves with, and what are the projects that are connected to those values, and how those connection generates a movement of transformation. That, for me, is the key in terms of future city transformation. That affects the way that we understand the city and the region. That I think is part of the same complex, part of the same complex system. So, if we keep trying to dissociate things, or even in a place like in Montreal, I think it's a fascinating place for this discussion because, I mean, you can try to avoid a question of identity in the city of Montreal, and then you kind of present a lot of programs that are technical smart city programs, and then you realize a lot of people don't even participate. They don't feel that they have nothing to do with them. Or they come from certain institutions that, yes, because they're coming from certain institutions, will not have a relevance for certain type of people. So if you don't understand that identity dynamic, I think we are missing a lot of. And normally it's identified with a negative connotation. Well, actually, there was the same discussion about the Aboriginal people as well. It's all about how that identity evolves into much more modern, and complex a scenario.
Alors, je vais partager avec vous la réaction que des étudiants en gestion de la marque et en marketing et développement durable ont eu lorsqu'on a travaillé ensemble sur le concept que je vous ai présenté aujourd'hui. I was very surprised to see that for them, memory was very important. They told us that Desjardins was built as a cooperative more than even a bank by us. And now that it's a bank, fantastic, but a bank, they really felt it was a unique opportunity to co-brand it as a founder of the new cities. And I was very surprised to see how for them, memory was key with la nature ou le territoire. And for them, anyway, with technology, it's all about the city, bigger or smaller. But they really felt that they wanted a place to express their potential, and they saw here a fantastic opportunity. So, and the last thing I want to be sure that I convey with you, our project is concrete. We will have 25 smart working centers in a few years. And we have a system to book, reserve, and bill, and control access. So many incubators, accelerators, business centers, Technopole want to join because they are stuck in the way to grow. So if they free some seats, they can join the network. So it's fun because cities and territories are configurating themselves in a new way. And if we think about network instead of center, because then you have the la polarisation de la décentralisation ou un grand centre, but network has no center. You know, and we are at the time where the economy, the network economy, is really starting very strongly.
Great. Thank you.
Maybe I can follow up on Gorka, your identity piece, because I think it's a really interesting one in the context of regions. A savvy political commentator said to me after Kathleen Wynne's majority win, it was the first time that suburbanites in the GTA had voted like urbanites. That they were starting to identify themselves with urban issues like housing costs, transportation and traffic and other green space and other issues. And I thought, I don't know if that's true, and we need some smart people to look at that data, but I thought it was a really perceptive point that made intuitive sense to me watching that election. The other one, I know that the mayor of Mississauga took a crack last night at the Scarborough subway for all very good reasons. But the fascinating thing about that debate, which from a policy perspective, it's a terrible decision. But it was fascinating to watch the inner suburb of Scarborough actually for the first time stand up for itself and start to have a Scarborough identity. And I thought that was actually quite an interesting moment from. So are we starting to identify differently in terms of city regions?
Yes, and also connecting with what you were saying, this phenomenon of how identities change, evolve, and actually can be a tool of transformation, you can also see that also in private companies, because the private company also has a narrative of themselves, and that narrative associated with certain values. So people in this company say, well, we want to see history is important, because history, in the way we read history, because history is nothing. I mean, it seems like it's a certain way of reading that history. Mm-hmm. Then you read it in a way that you select certain values that you want to associate with them. Mm-hmm. So it's a collective decision. It is not a historical fact. Mm-hmm. It is an instrument that you use. And I normally use the example, for example, of food in the Basque Country. We have the highest rate of Michelin star restaurants per square meter in the city of San Sebastian. And the Basque, we all think that we are genetically, you know, prepared to be good chefs. And what is real, this is real. And then, and you ask the Michelin chefs, and they say, well, 40 years ago, there was no, like, really good food in this country. Didn't exist. And now you ask people, people will say, oh, this comes from the Middle Age. You know, this is, you know, this is... So what has happened is that in a moment of really difficult time with violence, with industrial collapse, etc., that story was given an opportunity to associate yourself with positive values. So in neighborhoods like the ones you are saying, at some point, and we don't know why that happens, people decided to change the narrative and associate themselves with different values. And I think if we can understand that better and in a real, you know, in really true conversation at the city level, that has the power to change, you know, a lot of things.
And I think that particularly in suburb, where you need to create new des espaces de vie, you know, alive, so, yeah, resilient, livable places where it's not there just because you want to go to sleep or you have parking lot or shopping mall, but really eco-village, you know, mode de ville et mode de vie. I think that when you start to be able to work, then you will need a lot of new services, and people are talking now that instead of real estate, in fact, you will value the real estate because you are exchanging a lot of services, plein de services de proximité, and you have a lot of data understanding where people are coming from, what are the needs, because this system, as it is per usage, you can answer to the services of people. So I think it's a new tactical urbanism. It could be perceived like this also.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time. Smart working centers, transportation, representations. What we're, yeah. So we can take a couple of questions right now. So if you want to step up to the microphone to ask your questions. And please, could you move to the microphone, please? Thank you very much.
And maybe I can start off by asking Guillaume, how awesome is that mustache? That's it's not Movember, and that's
it's
awesome.
It's an experiment.
It's working.
My girlfriend likes it.
Pulling it off.
We have a mustache project at the end.
That's it. That's it.
My turn?
Yes.
Mutual Admiration Society. Thank you for those presentations. My name is Cameron Charlebois. I'm on the Evergreen Board of Directors, among other things. Simple question. John, you just raised the number of $90 billion, and I would like to know from the other two panelists what they would do with $90 billion to do what they're trying to do, as opposed to trying to solve the move GTA problem. And maybe you could say, if you had $90 billion to throw at other than transportation, what would it be to solve the transportation problem in Toronto?
So I think that's a hugely important point, that part of the theory of change for Evergreen City Works is we're about to build 100 years of infrastructure based off the mindset of the last 100 years. And we're about to build that. And I love your idea of the smart working centers. It's brilliant. I think, to me, it's offense and defense. Congestion is so bad in the GTA, and the transit system is so overwhelmed. $90 billion basically gets you an average system. I think that the kind of really interesting stuff that you're talking about is the optimization of the existing assets, which is even on top of that. I mean, the scariest stat I learned in my year at Metrolinx was that $90 billion, which includes operating as well, actually only keeps the GTA at the same congestion level it is now. That's how bad it is. 100,000 people and 50,000 cars are coming in every year. So maybe I'll turn it over to Louise.
But I think you're absolutely right, because when we present this project, you know, our smart cities, that's the big topic. We always face big corporation with three letters or more. But I mean, and je ne veux pas les démoniser, c'est pas mon but du tout. But what I want to say is that I love technology. You see my life. Huh? It's clear that I understand this power. But today, technology, when I look at San Francisco, which is a fantastic place, but look now, they are totally enslaved with the power of the big corporation. And they hate politics. And today, I'm very happy because we need to put together politics and technology. And politics should take care in this country about le prix des télécommunications. It's way too high. You know, and it should be approached in the proper way. And that's why I like our project, because it will help with the bank. They work with Microsoft, with Bell. Hey, let's go and bring it at the right place. And before spending billions of dollars in new roads for cars, and I love cars, but not the way it is used. It can be libre service, easily electric, you know. So why not retrofit what we have? And I love this idea of resilient urban cells. And I think because we have coopératives, on a une mémoire sociale, ici c'est encore possible d'être correct entre nous, amenons-le au monde. Nous sommes invités par Lisbonne, par Helsinki, tous des gens qui travaillent aussi avec des partenaires, mais Montréal, c'est à cette onde-là, je crois qu'on peut se différencier. Et Vojnia, qui était à Montréal récemment, et tout le monde lui a demandé, « Hey, Voj, c'est quoi le nouveau Silicon Valley? » Puis il a dit, « Oubliez, Silicon Valley, c'est fait. Faites quelque chose qui vous ressemble, quelque chose qui est près, de, comme tu disais, de l'identité, de ayez confiance en qui vous êtes. » Et je pense que c'est ce que notre projet propose.
Well, yes. I will take the money and I will go to the group of private companies and say, if you put the other, this is the 50% of a new investment fund, so you put the other 50%, we will design a collaborative process that will be based on the priorities that people are telling us. So we will take a very small part, one or two millions is fine for me, to conduct deep ethnographic research about what people really want and what are the priorities and how is that going to help fight inequality. And then once that you learn that, then you will do the high-level vision that somebody said yesterday that they have done, and then they go and consult. So you do the listening process, and then you design what is the collective impact process and the outcomes that you want to achieve collectively, public and private sector. And then you have the projects, and then you put the money in the projects. But without, I think, and this idea of disruptive social innovation funds that are public and private are coming. That is going to happen because the public sector doesn't have the money to solve these problems. The private sector knows that their business is decreasing because the system is not able to provide the services that used to provide. So these public-private funds are going to happen. The problem is how those funds are managed. And what is the connection with what really people on the ground want? Because if you take a public-private fund and it's controlled by the private capital, then you have a much bigger problem than what you have at the moment.
Thank you. Two more quick questions, please. I'm sorry, I see three people.
Donc deux questions, s'il vous plaît.
Sure. So my name is Carol. I'm the executive director of Apathy's Boring. We're a youth-led organization. Our mandate is actually to engage young people as active citizens. And so my question is directed to John, and I was just wondering, were you able to gauge the participation of youth in the work that you're doing? Because when I hear about the Air Mile survey, which is hilarious, as well as, you know, the landline calls to the mayor's office, for example, when I think about that, you know, young people aren't necessarily going to be reached via landlines or probably via an Air Miles push. So how do you see the participation of youth in this conversation? As well as, you know, my guess is in public transit, young people probably play quite a big role in populating that movement. And so if you could speak to that.
Yeah, it's funny. While it's the most accessible generation, they're very hard to reach. And I totally am with you, Air Miles. Oh, don't worry. We already chatted. I got her card because I do think it's a missing link. And so one of the things we just did, which I'd love to share with you, get your view on, is we just commissioned a paper on how to use social media best to engage people. So a bunch of new tools that are coming out there. It's not, you know, our Twitter handle isn't going to solve the world's problems here. But are there new ways of engaging online that are going to attract people to the conversations? So I think it's... I know you guys are working on it. It's an age-old problem, and we're grappling with it as well. I think we went for a specific demographic on our transit push, which was kind of more 25 to 50-year-old in the 905, but that's also because it was easier. So, huge challenge.
So. Hi. I have to stop now. I'm really sorry. We're running out of time. Is that it? I'm sorry. I said two, but we're going to be here for a while. So
okay. So we're going to take a very short 10-minute break. What in Ontario they euphemistically call a personal break. So please be back in 10 minutes. We've got two very interesting presentations remaining in the day.
And I want to thank my panel, too. So.
Thank you.